This is John Floridis. Welcome to Musician Spotlight. Today we welcome Lee Ritenour. This is John Floridis, and you're listening to Musician Spotlight. I'm very pleased to welcome to the show today Lee Ritenour. How are you doing?
Just fine, John. Glad to be talking to you in the state.
Exactly. Glad to be speaking with you as well. And I want to let listeners know that we are having this conversation with Lee in late August, and we are sitting in a pretty decked out Mercedes RV. And this is the press room, as it were, here at the Crown of the Continent Guitar Festival. Lee, a lot of our listeners are going to be very familiar with your work, and certainly a true musician's musician, Grammy Award winner, multiple nominee. And if I'm not mistaken, Rhythm Sessions is the most recent recording.
Yeah, I'm overdue to get back in the studio this year, but I've been I haven't had the chance. I've been traveling so much, you know. That's the other thing that happened is that I have about 45 solo albums out, and I was usually good for just about one a year, but that has slowed down, not because I've slowed down. As a matter of fact, I think I'm busier than ever, but I'm because record sales were not as strong as they once were, because people are, first of all, could take the music out of the air, and now there's things like streaming, and CDs are almost kaput. But so traveling ended up being the thing to get the word out of your own music, you know. So, and I enjoy it. I travel all over the world constantly, and the fans are fantastic.
I want to come back to that traveling all over the world part of the component, that component of your career, but I want to go back to, you mentioned, of course, a session, your session work, which to say the least is one of your calling cards. I knew that that was a huge part of your career. 3,000 sessions, it says on your website, that boggles the mind. I want to go back to that first one, the Mamas and the Papas, and where you got the nickname of Captain Fingers, if I'm not mistaken. Talk to me about that first time you went into that kind of situation and that experience and how that shaped you, because you were, what, 16, 17 years old?
Yeah. And so it was about 1968, and the Mamas and Papas were going strong, and John Phillips, I ended up getting lucky and getting in this sort of semi-local band, semi-professional band that was combining jazz and rock. The guy had kind of a Latin jazz group, and then he hired a singer to sound like Janis Joplin, and he was going to cross over, and somehow he got connected with John Phillips, and Phillips was going to produce our first demo. So we'd go up to his house. I wasn't even driving at that point. I think my dad had to drive me. He had a house, one of those mansions in Beverly Hills, and he had a recording studio, a completely pro recording studio on the second floor of his house, which in the late 60s, nobody was doing that. That became very common later. So the guy produced our demo. The band didn't go anywhere. The demo didn't go anywhere. But John asked me to stay for a couple of days, and there was another young studio guys that he brought in that were a little older than me, a famous bass player that played with Carole King and James Taylor, Leland Sklar on bass, Ed Green on drums, who did all the Barry White stuff and was a big Motown drummer. So those two guys were there, and I knew who they were and already, and we did this session, and then for years I looked for the record to come out, and to my knowledge, if it came out, it came out years later. I heard later that John recorded constantly, and there were tapes just, you know, lined wall to wall in his studio, and it probably made the light of day at some point, but I got frustrated looking for it, because I was hoping, you know, it would be my first release, but I don't know if it ever really got released. But and that wasn't really, that was an anomaly, but it was, you know, like with the Mamas and the Papas, so that was cool. But it was a couple years later, when I was 18, maybe almost 19, that I met through a Brazilian guitarist that passed recently, Oscar Castro Neves, a fantastic guitarist. I got to know Oscar. He introduced me to Sergio Mendes. Through Sergio Mendes, I met my buddy Dave Grusin. And through Dave Grusin, I met Antonio Carlos Jobim, the great legendary Brazilian writer. So Dave started using me on his sessions, and he was the number one movie composer at the time in Los Angeles. So if Dave was using this kid, that was kind of okay for everybody else. And so I went from doing, you know, one session every couple of weeks to 10 a week, and then 15, and then sometimes 20. So that's how that studio career started.
Lee, I wanted to go back to, you know, we were talking about your first session work with the mamas and papas and what that led, how that led to that part of your career. I want to go back even further to referencing something I found online in an interview. From what I understand, it was at an early age that you became, in your words, kind of a geek in terms of sound and recording and guitar. But what struck me was that you had an early interest in pedals, not so much, I don't want to talk, you know, the gear talk so much, but just the idea of being able to manipulate sound and how that really grabbed you. And talk about that a little bit.
Well, I think that's why I was probably a successful studio musician. You know, I had studied a lot. I was definitely did a lot of studying, practicing. I became obsessive with the guitar by the time I was 12. I started when I was 8. By the time I was 13, in the summer times, I was practicing 5 to 10 hours a day, and it was a great time for the guitar because you know, there was all these great jazz guitar players: Wes Montgomery, Joe Pass, Kenny Burrell, Jim Hall, you know, Chet Atkins on the countryside, and other great players: B.B. King, Albert King, John Lee Hooker, you know, Segovia on the classical side, Sabikas on the flamenco side, and you know, on the rock side, which was just exploding, was Jimi Hendrix, and then came Jeff Beck and Eric Clapton and Townsend and all these guys, right? And so, I ended up just loving the guitar of anybody that could play it well. I loved it. You know, Jimmy Bryant playing great country guitar, you know, the Kingston Trio, you know, all these, the folk stuff, you know, Dylan coming along. So I was just Motown. I loved the rhythm guitar playing of Motown. That became kind of a strong suit for me too as a studio musician. But when I heard Hendrix, I couldn't really grasp his sound. It was just so overwhelming, you know, compared to anything else that had gone on. But, you know, then I got interested in distortion boxes and wah-wahs and stuff, and I added, and I was very schooled. I was always a good sight reader, and so when I started doing movie dates, I had all these pedals, and I would kind of orchestrate and paint pictures for the composer, and I think I was one of the earlier guys that was doing that.
I love that analogy. I've heard musicians use that occasionally, but it seems very apropos in that regard.
Yeah, exactly. So it and you know, because you can't write those kind of sounds on a piece of paper. You know, you have to have the taste, and you have to have whether the producer on the session of a record date or a movie session, you have to have the producer or the arranger saying, "Do your thing, man. You know, add these colors." You know, yeah. And we would do these Barry White sessions with four guitar players, and so we would all bring colors and different things to these sessions. It was really fun.
Thank you. This is John Floridis. You're listening to Musician Spotlight, and we're speaking today with Lee Ritenour. You've always been an LA guy, and I wanted to ask how that city and the scene, of course, but just the city itself, how that shaped you, not even so much as a player, but just as a person.
Well, I was born and raised in LA. I'm one of the guys that loves LA, even with all the freaking traffic. And, you know, the city's gotten more crowded as years have gone on, but it's also gotten better in a lot of ways. There's just a diversity out there of people and music and musicians. It's one of the greatest bases for musicians and the technical side, because as you mentioned, I am a recording nut and making sure my guitar is recorded great, and all the technical side of the innovations are out there in LA, and there's just a plethora of fantastic players. So it was a great place to grow up. My dad was a great enthusiast of music and would take me to all the clubs. And back in those days, when I was growing up, there was more clubs than there are now. So, you know, I would go to all these great jazz clubs, and then the rock scene was happening. And he would take me to my music lessons in the San Fernando Valley, but we would drive through Hollywood to get there. And we'd stop at a place called Wallach's Music City, and which was Sunset and Vine. And, you know, all these new young rockers, you know, the Buffalo Springfield guys and the Turtles and all these groups would be hanging out there, you know, and they were all young, and it was a tremendous energy in LA at that time. Mm-hmm. So it was a great period to grow up there. And it's, I still love LA. It's a, I'm fortunate enough to live at the beach, and it has affected my music. You know, the East Coast sound and the West Coast sound is very different. You know, my music's very positive, very rhythmic, I think living in all that sunshine is one reason.
Certainly, it would seem that would be the case. And I wanted to touch on the international flavor of your music and your journey with music. Talk about how that developed. Was it being in LA and maybe being introduced to some different cultures? Did that play a part in that, or was the thing where music kind of drew you into some of these different cultures?
The first market that broke for me when I started doing my own records, my first album came out in 1976, and I was about 25 when I made the record. And right around that same time, I did a specialty audio recording for a company in Japan. And it was called a direct-to-disc, where you'd record the whole side at once, and it was cut right onto the mother lave of the vinyl, and it was a very hi-fi sounding thing. And that broke huge for me in Japan. Mm-hmm. And So I got hired to go on a tour to Japan, and I had been there once before with Sergio Mendes, but this was now as my own group. And I got to the airport, and there was like banners and girls, and it was like, you know, rock star stuff. And I had no idea, and this record had like exploded there. And so Japan became a huge market for me, still is, and the fans are unbelievable there. They're just so consistent, and those fans that were 20 years old when I was 20, they're still with me, you know. Mm-hmm. And yet they also have a nice base of having younger fans come along, you know. Where in this country, it's more like each generation kind of stays with their generation of, so for instance, my fans here are older now, you know, but around the rest of the world, you see a lot of young kids come into the concerts, and people, teenagers and 20s, and that's very cool. And then I started to travel more around Europe and other parts, and I have a big love of Brazilian music. My son is half Brazilian, my wife is Brazilian, and and before I met her and had Wes, I was into Brazilian music. So there's a sort of that world music flavor to my stuff as well, especially from the Brazilian side. And so that, I think that helped. And also, since my music is primarily instrumental, I've had some vocal hits like Is It You and Mr. Briefcase and those songs. But, you know, my main thing is the guitar, and the main thrust is instrumentals. And around the world, that plays, because you don't have the translation, you don't have the language barrier. But, you know, musicians like to say we are the true ambassadors, especially for the U.S., because we have such great music coming out of the U.S., and the U.S. musicians travel a lot overseas, and And, you know, it sounds like a cliche, but we do bring smiles to people, and we are the true ambassadors. And sometimes we always have this habit of saying, I wish everybody would just close their mouth and quit talking and let the musicians cure the planet. Because, you know, the music is, I mean, I was just in Russia 2 weeks ago, and we know what's going on with that place and the Ukraine and everything. And you know, we were a little nervous about going over there, but the trip had been booked for a long time. And, you know, it was, the music was well received, and everybody was smiling, you know. So that's like we always say, let the music do the talking.
Before we wrap up the interview, I had to ask you about something that came to my attention here in the last couple of days. Apparently, the BBC did a poll of the greatest guitar riffs of all time. Yeah. And so Whole Lotta Love took the gold. Uh-huh. But I wanted to ask you about that. Okay, let's just for fun here, talk about some, just off the top of your head, your favorite guitar riffs of all time.
Oh, wow. Jesus, that's a toughie. Well, number of the Hendrix riffs, you know, that would be hard to beat, you know, that any of those tunes, the classic tunes from Purple Haze, and, you know, that, and, you know, but the the Led Zeppelin stuff, I mean, they would, and the Stones, those guys just would come up with fantastic parts, you know. I kind of miss that in music right now.
I was thinking the same thing.
That, you know, these classic guitar licks that painted so many pictures of these great pop hits and stuff, you know. And that was what was fun about being a session player, because that was, if you got to have that coveted job of being the number one or two or three or four top five guys in New York City or LA or London or wherever it was, or Nashville, you would, you know, you were expected. And the reason you got those parts is because you would come up with these cool licks that became, in some cases, the whole hook of the tune, you know. And, you know, that documentary In the Shadow of Motown is a perfect example of how that rhythm section back there in Detroit, you know, made the Motown sound, you know. So that's a great example. But those classic rock riffs are just incredible.
LeeRittenhour.com is where you can find out more about what Lee is doing. Thank you so much for making time to be on Musician Spotlight. It's been a pleasure to finally meet you and get a chance to talk shop with you, and I hope it's not the last time.
All right. Thank you, John, and it's a pleasure to be here in this beautiful state.
This is John Floridis. You've been listening to Musicians Spotlight. Our guest today has been Lee Ritenour. If you'd like to contact us, you can do so through the Montana Public Radio website, mtpr.org. You can also contact us through our own website, musicianspotlight.org, as well as through Facebook. Our program is now available as a downloadable podcast from those websites as well as from iTunes. Special thanks to the Crown of the Continent Guitar Festival for this interview. Musicians Spotlight is a production of Montana Public Radio.